Lannery was looking forward to time on her own with Dale. Yet now she is fearful as well. Of Dale. What he is becoming. And what he might do. She is desperate to not let her parents down. And though she still tries to believe that her brother can be saved and brought to the Force, deep down she knows the truth. His days on Tython are numbered.
Wait here,
Master Kinnaid says. She rests a hand on Lannery's shoulder.
This is the last time we'll see each other, for now at least. I hope your onward journey is safe, Journeyer. May the Force go with you.
Thank you for all your training, Lannery says. Master Kinnaid looks as though she wants to say more, and Lannery is surprised when she senses doubt exuding from the Master. But then the room beyond where they wait is no longer empty, and Kinnaid merely smiles.
Enter,
a voice says, and Lannery recognizes Law-Mi once more. The small hexagonal room is lined with images of people Lannery does not know. There are a mix of people, all species and colors, and at points around the walls there are also empty spaces. Law-Mi stands in a doorway on the far side of the room.
Everyone I have let down, the Temple Master says. All those people, Jedi and not, whom I have failed throughout my long life. I keep the room open for anyone to view, because it's important to know we are not all perfect. Pride is a dangerous indulgence. I'm a Temple Master now, but even that doesn't exclude me from failure. In many regards, my failures are greater, because as a Temple Master, there is so much more expectation put upon me, and responsibility brings more risk.
Lannery says nothing. She is being spoken to, and Law-Mi invites no response.
It's down to me, of course, whose images I place here,
the old man continues.
Some would argue that there are those here who let themselves down, rather than being let down by me. And there are others who might name some images that are missing.
He walks slowly around the room.
There are spaces, gaps yet to fill. I hope to still see areas of bare wall here when I am older and closer to death, but...
He shrugs and touches cold, bare stone.
You don't want to see Dale's image here,
Law-Mi says.
You're learning well, and your experience shines through. But it's your face I have no wish to see on the walls of this room, Lannery. So heed this warning. Ignore it, suffer the consequences, and I will have let you down. Your brother grows more unstable and dangerous every day. Be wary of him.
I will, Master Law-Mi.
The old man sighs.
There was a time when people like Dalian...
He trails off.
What?
Lannery asks.
Harsher times, Law-Mi says. No matter. Go safe, Lannery Brock, and may the Force go with you.
Lannery watches the Temple Master turn and leave the room of his shame, and when he is gone, she spends some time looking around at the faces staring back at her. She wonders what became of them. Dead? Banished? Fled out into the system? She hopes to never find out. And she swears that neither her face nor her brother's will fill one of those empty spaces. Down in Greenwood Station, Trisana became someone else. Lannery sensed it when they emerged onto the first bustling street of shops, taverns, and other places of pleasure. Not in any Force way, because whatever Dan Powell had done to the Twi'lek had rendered him almost immune to Lannery's probings. But in the way he carried himself, his manner, his bearing, his interaction with the world shifted subtly. The Trisana she had met on Calamar, and with whom she had spent days cooped up in her peacemaker, turned into the man Dan Powell had warned her about. He became dangerous. They walked along the street side by side, and Lannery kept the hood of her robe raised. A few people glanced at them, but only casually. Most were too involved in their own lives to be concerned with anyone else. Sellers displayed their wares on metal market wagons, food, drink,
and an array of drug slips that promised a temporary escape from the reality of this wretched place. People stood outside drinking establishments, trying to lure passersby inside with promises of the best drink. And all the while, farther toward the center of the dome, the chimneys throbbed and pumped, the machines thumped away, the ground shook, and great trains trundled in or out with raw materials or finished products. The people were the oil that kept the dome working, and Lannery sensed that safety and sanity here rested on a thin skein of smoke. While they walked, she kept her senses open for any sign of Dale. But she wasn't even sure she would recognize him anymore.
"There,"
Tree said. He pointed along the street. "What?"
"Listing point."
He walked forward, shoved a tall man aside, and pressed several buttons on a box mounted on a short, stumpy pole.
"I was using that,"
the man said. He might once have been human, but some terrible growth had eaten at his face, and gleaming artificial eyes were set in the remains of eye sockets.
"How about using this?"
Tree said. He shifted his jacket aside and displayed the small blaster on his belt. "I didn't even know he had that," Lannery thought.
"You're carrying,"
the man said.
"No one's allowed to carry in Green..."
Tree shoved him hard. Arms pinwheeling, the man stumbled back into a group of women wearing dull red work suits, and one of them tripped him. They laughed. Tree turned his back on the fallen man and started working at the listing point. Its small screen showed a map of Greenwood Station, and as Tree tapped at the keys, the map zoomed into a sector, then a small network of streets. A green glow pulsed. Tree swiped the screen clear and nodded at Lannery. "The scumhead is listed?" Lannery asked.
"No, but someone who knows him is."
"Right. Easy." Tree started walking. "You could have waited to use it," she said, walking alongside the Twi'lek.
"Just keeping up appearances."
"I thought you hadn't been here before."
"I haven't, but I know how to get by here. Trust me."
Lannery tried to smile and roll her eyes, but Tree was not even looking at her. Someone had been run over by a train. Lannery saw the commotion as they approached a wide road that led to a tunnel mouth beneath the dome's lower edge. A woman was screaming in grief, and a small crowd had gathered around a sickening red smudge on the road's rough surface. Most people quickly walked on. The trains must have been huge and heavy, because there wasn't much left. "No security? No help?" Lannery asked.
"There's some, if you can afford it," Tree said. "But Greenwood Station is like any other city on Nox, run by the corporations. They're the law, and the people work for them. What security does exist is concerned with maintaining production, ensuring the safety of corporation members, most of whom probably live in the central tower, and protecting the city from attacks from other cities."
"That still goes on?"
"More often than you think. Come on, nothing to see here."
They walked on, and Lannery spared one final glance for the grieving woman. "Sounds more like Chicago," she said.
"Oh, it's nowhere near as organized,"
Tree said. They crossed the wide train track and entered a district closer to the central manufacturing zones. The ground shook with a constant vibration, and the workers' accommodation buildings were much more regimented. People moved through the streets, red-clad workers on their way to or from work, and here and there were groups of armed guards, watching for trouble but apparently expecting none. Their weapons were obviously displayed, and they all looked mean. Lannery touched the weight of her sword and kept her face down. It was doubtful that anyone would identify her as Jedi simply by looking at her, but she could not disconnect from who she was so easily. She feared her eyes, her expression, would betray her.
"Here,"
Tree said, nodding at a gray accommodation tower.
"Not the scumhead, but an associate. Equally unpleasant."
"Can't wait," Lannery said. Inside the tower, up 14 flights of stairs because the elevator was broken, and when Tree knocked at a door, there was no answer. Lannery kicked it in. The person who'd been pressed, listening to the other side, fell back and tripped over a piece of furniture, spilling drug slips and bottles of a rancid-smelling drink. Lannery force-shoved the door closed and pressed it into its broken frame.
"Well," Tree said, "Lannery, meet Dom, a business contact of mine."
"Still keeping fine company, I see, Tree-sana,"
Dom said from the floor.
"She's virtually asleep right now," Tree said, going with the flow.
Lannery was impressed.
"You'd hate to see her awake and angry."
"I know a Jedi when I meet one."
Lannery was on the fallen man in an instant, sword drawn and pressed against his throat before he could draw another breath.
"You know one of these, too?" she asked.
"No,"
Dom said. He was Zabrak, but terrible wounds disfigured his face, leaving a tracery of scars behind. His breath stank of chemical staleness.
"But my father did. One of your sort parted his head from his shoulders 12 years ago.
"Where?"
"Kaleth."
"Then he shouldn't have been there," Lannery said. "We were protecting our own. That's what I'm doing now. And you know the Jedi. Protecting their own? We're more than happy to take heads."
She pressed down on the sword, knowing exactly how much pressure to exert before drawing blood.
"I'm looking for Max Haugen," Tree said.
"So?"
"Come on, Dom.
Find him yourself."
"You tell us. It'll save us time," Lannery said. "Don't be like your father."
A flash of fear was replaced by defiance in Dom's eyes. He even managed to smile against the sword's pressure.
"You won't just slaughter me," he said.
"Yes, she will." Lannery pushed the thought. "She's mean and desperate, and she'll take my head from my shoulders without even breathing heavily."
Dom's smile dropped, and he looked nervously back and forth between Tree and Lannery. He smiled, defeated. His anger faded away, and Lannery wondered if he really cared about his dead father at all. Maybe it was just a convenient reason to hate.
"Let me up,"
Dom said. "No."
"I need to stand and..."
"No," Lannery said again. "You'll get up, feign weakness, lean against that cupboard over there. Then you'll try to distract us and take the blaster that's stuck beneath its upper table. You might even get off one shot. But then I'll kill you, and that'll be an inconvenience to me. So no, you're not getting up. And now my pressure on this sword will continue to increase until you tell us where Max Haugen can be found." Dom's eyes had grown wide as he heard the thoughts plucked from his mind. Lannery smiled. "And if you could read my thoughts, you'd know I tell the truth." She leaned down on the sword, and its keen edge pressed against the heavy scar tissue on his throat. Skin split. Blood flowed.
"District 6,
Dom said.
"Market. He runs a stall, selling imported water."
Lannery frowned, but could sense no lie in Dom's words.
"Hiding in plain sight," Tree said. "I think he's telling the truth."
"He is," Lannery said.
She started to ease back on the sword.
"You should kill him,"
Tree said. His words were light, unburdened by feeling. "Kill him?"
"He knows you're a Jedi. Knows we're here. And we're already at a disadvantage. One call from him to anyone in Greenwood Station, and we're compromised."
Lannery never looked away from the man beneath her sword. There had been many whose flesh had parted around this blade, but all of them had been fighting back at the time. Shooting down the pilots had been unavoidable, though their deaths pained her. She was not in the habit of killing for killing's sake.
"There's another way," she said.
She sheathed her sword and sat up astride Dom's chest. He did not move. He seemed to sense that this was far from over.
"We don't have time," Tree said.
"This won't take long."
Lannery calmed herself and gathered the force, and Master Dan Powell's face and voice came to her.
"There are some who are troubled by what you and I excel at, but they don't understand the potential. Maintain control, keep yourself balanced, and it will serve you well."
Lannery felt the power of the force swirling and flowing within and around her, personified by Ashlaw and Bogan, their attraction and repulsion perfectly balanced, and Lannery suspended weightless, faultless between them. She lifted skin dust from the floor and chose four particles, and they became her servants. Concentrating on them, expanding them in her vision, and giving them a touch of the Force, she dropped them into Dom's upturned eyes. He blinked and cried out, but could not move. His eyes watered, and then he squeezed them closed. But by then it was too late.
"I'll wait outside," Lannery heard Tree say, and he sounded like a child afraid of the dark.
But her eyes were closed, and she did not see him leave.
"Keep calm. Keep quiet," she whispered, with a slight Force push, and Dom grew motionless beneath her.
She delved down, vision growing dark, the sense of touch intense and shocking as the dust particles forged through his eyes and back into his brain. She felt the warm wetness of his insides. She sought. The dust sought. And when she found the places she wanted, she paused, gathering strength and molding the Force to her will. This was the dangerous part. She felt Bogan looming and darkness closing, and balance drifted. Power grew around her, and she breathed deeply, trying to ward off the ecstatic sensations flooding through her. The pleasure of control. The ecstasy of darkness. The dust transformed into elements of her will, and Dom started to choke as her will was done.
"Keep calm," Lannery thought, and this time she was speaking to herself.
Bogan grew large and heavy, and she felt the irresistible lure of shadow, freedom from constraint, reveling in power. And she fought her way back to balance, the denial of Bogan difficult but ultimately triumphant. The sense of loss was staggering for a time, but it quickly faded. This was her talent, Dan Powell had told her. The alchemy of flesh, however minute that element of flesh might be. Transformation. Transition. And Lannery tried to hold down the sense of pride at her achievement. She had not touched the experiment on her ship since the start of this mission, but she had not lost anything that she had learned. She stood from Dom and went to the door that Tree had left open behind him. "It's done," she said, and Tree's voice answered from the corridor beyond.
"You had the face of Dan Powell. Her darkness."
"And her control," Lannery said. "Of course. Dan Powell must have performed something similar on Tree." But Lannery didn't mind frightening him. Tree afraid might serve her well.
"Is he..."
I seared his memory. For a time, he'll remember nothing, not even his name. Dom writhed on the floor and struggled to stand.
"For a time?"
Tree asked. "I'm not sure how long." And she was not. It could be mere days, or perhaps much longer, until Dom returned to the damaged person he had been. A dark shadow in his mind where the memory of what had happened was a charred emptiness. Better than murder.
"If you say so."
Tree was standing in the corridor, back against the wall. "Now tell me you know where District 6's market is," she said. Tree nodded. There was no easy smile this time. Chapter 11. Slaves.
"There are depths."
Usamael Orr, circa 1000 TYA. So your arrival. Part of a journeyer's pilgrimage is to learn how to survive in the wild. And now, they are hunting. Lannery stalks through the forest of giant fungi, breathing through her mouth so that the meaty scent of the huge mushrooms does not throw her senses. Her footfalls are completely silent. She can sense the areas of dried fungus skin that might crackle when she steps, or those places where a hollow in the ground is covered with moss. Her breathing is light and slow, and her mind is connected with their quarry, a small mammal. She can feel its rapid heartbeat and breathing, and if she really concentrates, she can see through its eyes. Its perception is so much different from hers. Everything it sees is shaded by the Force. It used to trouble her that so much wildlife on Tython was so in tune with the tides of the Force. But she has grown to learn that theirs is a passive relationship. It is only Jedi who can harness the Force and use it to perform great deeds. Her movements urge the mammal onward, down into the shallow ravine, past the growth of pink mushrooms that blankets one wall, and then she sees a flurry of movement ahead. A whistle in the distance, and then Lannery runs between the milky white stems. She revels in the silent movement, the breeze riffling her loosened hair, sweat lifted from her brow. When she arrives at the edge of the ravine and looks down, Dale is holding up the creature pierced on a spear he fashioned himself. She smiles. "We make a good team," she thinks. But then that familiar pang of guilt stabs in once again. They are 6 days out from Stav Kesh, and every moment that passes, Lannery knows she is lying to herself. Dale will never accept the Force, nor adjust to its ebb and flow. Silently, he skins, guts, and butchers the creature, builds a fire, and starts cooking the meat. Everything he does is methodical and skilled. He's learning so much. Lannery remembers overhearing their father talking to their mother once. "He's like a sponge," their father said. "Every question of his I answer inspires two more. His thirst for knowledge is insatiable. He's going to be a great Jedi one day." It saddens her how her parents could have been so wrong. Dale's skills hide a deeper void within him. A dark void, where all around expect the Force to dwell. And at last, as he starts serving the meat with a soft, sweet root vegetable they gathered earlier, she asks the question that has been burning at her. "Are you sad?" He gives her a plate. The food smells wonderful. Dale's expression does not shift. He knows exactly what she means.
"Eat your dinner," he says. "We've a long way to go yet."
"Are you sad?" she asks again. "The way you were at Stav Kesh, like a child, jealous of those around him with better toys." Dale raises an eyebrow and then laughs out loud.
"Is that what you think?"
he asks.
"Well..."
"You really think I'm jealous of you? Of mother and father and those others we trained with back there? Jealous that none of you are your own masters?"
"Of course we are."
"No!"
He places his plate down and stands, not angry but frustrated.
"No, not at all. You're slaves to the Force. You might think it serves you, but you serve it. You never have your own thoughts, because the Force is always on your mind. You never fight your own fights, because the Force fights for you."
"It's not like that, Dale. It's..."
"Well, that's what I see," Dale says. "I watch you use it, and when you do, you're not yourself. You're not my sister."
"I thought I knew what was best for you," she says.
"But you don't! Only I can say that. Our parents, you, the masters who trained us, everyone wants to tell me what to be, to force something upon me. But I'm my own man, my own master."
His eyes go wide, as does his smile. And it's not madness or fury that Lannery sees there. It's joy. "What are you going to do?" she asks. Dale looks to the dusky sky, where stars are already emerging, and Ashlaw and Bogan peer from behind a haze of clouds. 100 lights move high up, satellites and spacecraft drifting high above Tython's atmosphere.
"I'm going to learn," he says, "everything I can from every temple we both visit. And then after that, I'm going to the stars."
"The stars?"
"I'm going to find my way home."
He says no more, does not elaborate. And Lannery's overriding fear is one of sadness, that the home they have together with their parents is not enough for Dale. Five days later, After journeying across the eastern extreme of Cato Zakar, where fungi forests gave way to swamps, and those in turn soon became sand dunes rolling kilometers toward the sea. They approached the coast from where the first of the Moon Islands is visible on the horizon. 100 kilometers and 7 islands beyond, the continent of Tulse. Though they talk and travel together, the distance between them is widening with every day. Lannery can feel that, and she senses that Dale does too. The difference is that he welcomes it. Dale breathes in deeply. He is invigorated by the energy of the ocean and the violence of the waves.
Beautiful, he says. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful, Lannery?
Rain is falling. The sea smashes against the sandy shore, the heavy dunes they stand upon fleeting in the lifetime of Tython. The waves are topped with a rolling luminescence in the dawn light, countless minute creatures casting their glow across the waters. She can feel the power through her feet. It is humbling and, yes, beautiful.
It's amazing, she says.
Puts your force to shame, huh?
He grins, and the sea breeze blows sheets of rain that soak his hair. Lannery does not respond, though she could. She could tell him that the power he feels is the force, because it flows through the sea as well as the air and rock, the plants and ground, the living things that fly and run and crawl, and the dead things that rot beneath the soil and under the waves. She could tell him, but he would not listen. Worse, he would not understand. So she closes her eyes, and the rain and sea spray soak her as well. Later, in the coastal port of Ban Landing, they are offered an escorted crossing to Tulse.
The gelfish swarms are further south than ever this year, the woman says.
She has not told them her name, but she wears a ranger star at her belt.
I've been across the Moon Islands and back 7 times, and each time the craft I was in was attacked. I'd advise a scheduled crossing, Jarniers. Those larger ships have special defenses to deal with anything the Moon Channel can throw at them, and if you go alone, you'll only have a small sailing boat.
We go alone, Dale says.
Eh, Lannery? We're journeying to learn and explore, after all.
The ranger objects, and yet Lannery sees a flash of respect in her eyes. Perhaps on her own great journey she did the same, though she does not tell them. They spend the night in Ban Landing, staying in a simple bunkhouse close to the water's edge. In the wooden beams that hold up the roof are carved thousands of names, journeyers from years past who stayed here before their own dangerous crossings of the Moon Islands to Tulse. Lannery spends some time looking for their parents' names, but she does not find them. Later, Dale sits out on the deck surrounding the bunkhouse. Great waves break on the beaches 0.5 kilometer away, and lit by starlight, only their swirling, luminous tops are visible, like giant coiling snakes in the dark. But she is looking at her brother. He lies on his back with his hands resting behind his head, staring up.
Food? Lannery says.
Dale takes the plate she has brought him and nods his thanks.
It'll be dangerous.
Don't worry, little sister,
Dale says, even though she is older than he.
I'll look after you.
Their journey across the Moon Channel takes only 3 days, but Lannery will remember it forever. The sea is calmer when they set out at dawn the following day. The ranger meets them at the harbor and tells them how she has used the force to confuse and combat the threat of sea creatures, the deadly gelfish most of all, on her previous crossings. Then she wishes them well. They sail from island to island, stopping only to replenish water canteens before moving on. They sleep briefly on land, but spend all their waking time afloat. A storm blows up halfway through their journey. A gelfish swarm hits their boat and starts climbing the hull, oozing toxic tentacles whipping at the air and seeking flesh. Lannery uses the force to punch them back into the sea. Dale uses his blaster to blow groups of them apart before they even reach the boat. The swarm passes, but they are not out of danger. A sea serpent appears as if from nowhere and almost capsizes the boat. Its head as big as a person's torso, teeth dripping venom.
Lannery disorients the beast by touching its mind, and Dale stabs it several times with a boat hook. It slips away and flees, and Lannery senses it going deep, seeking a dark hole to hide in and repair its wounds. They battle together, taking on Tython's dangers, weathering its storms. But when they reach Tals at last, landing in a small seaport, Dale sets off from the moored boat without another word. For him, there is no time to waste, no point in stopping to rest. It's as if Anil Kesh has something for him, and he is impatient to get there. Storms thrash above Tals. Heavy rain strikes them like a hail of small stones. Lightning thrashes, and Lannery feels eddies in the force. The force storm makes her feel sick and unsteady, and Dale grabs her arm and helps her along. There's a new purpose in him now, and Lannery only wishes she knew what drove it. The Temple of Science is still 2 days' travel inland.
He calls it the Network, Tree said. It's a loose collection of contacts, informers, and spies, not only in Greenwood Station, but in almost every domed city on Nox, sometimes beyond. So loose that any break in the network protects everyone else. Any disruption to the links in its web cuts off everyone else. It's genius, really.
He sounded almost respectful.
It's taken Max Hagen years to set it up, and he won't risk it unless we make it worth his while.
And you've met Max Hagen? Used his network?
No to both. But he and I have conducted business.
Just what have you...
It's him you need to know about right now,
Tree said sternly.
I mean it, Lannery. I like you. I have shadows in my past, and I'm sure Dan Powell suggested that to you. But Max Hagen isn't someone to fool with. He's the real deal. A maniac. A monster.
They had crossed a stinking, polluted canal on a rickety bridge, and were now in District 6. At its far end stood the rock and metal tower that acted as Greenwood Station's central buttress, every gigantic spine of the immense dome curving back and down from the tower's pinnacle. At ground level, it was so wide that it would take half a morning to walk around, and its top was hidden within a haze of smoke and steam. Craft buzzed to and from the tower, both airships and powered vessels. There was even some green up there, Lannery noticed. Garden balconies overflowed, and all across District 6, petals and leaves were crushed into the pavement by countless feet. It was as if those in the tower teased the rest of the dome with what they had. District 6 itself was a mix of large factory buildings, storage warehouses, contained outdoor parks for larger produce. Lannery had seen a large area half-filled with ranks of ground assault vehicles of various shapes and sizes, and a network of squares around which hunkered accommodation and administration towers. The squares bustled with people going to and from work, and the largest housed a huge market where workers spent their pay. They were closing in on that square now, a huge factory belching and thundering to their left, a soot-smothered five-story office building to their right. Lannery wondered how people managed to live and work in such a place, but she knew that many did not have a choice. People were born and died on Nox, their lives mapped out from beginning to end. Most earned just enough to survive in one of the domes, sometimes affording a few luxuries from time to time. But to leave the planet would cost more than most could ever save in a lifetime. No doubt the corporations liked it that way. Lannery looked up at the high dome, barely visible above them, and the noisy, stinking factory to their left. Dale could be anywhere here. She felt a rush of urgency, not only to catch him, but to see him again. I've dealt with monsters before, Lannery said.
Yeah, and fought them, I'll bet. But Max Hagen is a monster with brains. 4 years ago, he was crossed by a family from Volkhaus on Chicauqua. They'd bought some information from him that helped them establish a production base in Crystal City, a dome 800 kilometers south of here. Then they refused to pay. Killed three of his messengers, and withdrew to Chicauqua with all their business gains intact. They paused as a train approached, and moved to one side, letting the massive transport trundle by along its tracks,
in the middle of the road.
So, this is a tale of revenge, and what terrible retribution he brought down on them, Lannery said. She knew what to expect. Her previous visit to Knox had been brief, but she knew people like Max Hagen. She'd met them all over the system.
In a way, Tree said, it took him a while. But he conspired to initiate a feud in Crystal City, and that resulted in a skirmish that left 3,000 dead. Wiped out the Volk family's entire network on Knox, and there was no link whatsoever to Max Hagen. He wasn't interested in ego or in anyone knowing it was he who caused it. He didn't want infamy. He just wanted revenge.
Yet infamy is his.
Tree shrugged.
These things become known.
A sharp mind, then.
Sharp and brutal. The 3,000 included many children. I doubt he had trouble sleeping that night.
So he makes all his money from information?
The best way there is to make money.
Tree gestured around them at the buildings, the air hazy despite the air treatment units drifting and thundering around the dome's massive airspace.
This is all fleeting, constantly assaulted by the atmosphere. Or it can be destroyed, as we saw on the way in. Information is eternal, and that's where Max Hagen places his faith.
So is the Force, Lannery said. I'll put my faith in that.
My faith is here, Tree said,
touched the bulge of his blaster on his belt. Imported water, Lannery said. Seems ironic that he deals in something that represents purity.
Good cover, Tree said. And I don't know about you, but I could do with a drink.
They moved on, and soon, District 6's huge central square came into view in a shallow valley. It was a sea of movement, and for a moment, looking down into it, Lannery felt queasy. Countless people swarmed and swirled. Market stalls and more impressive structures strove to take their money from them. The smells of cooking mixed with the dome's manufacturing stenches and made her stomach turn. Somewhere down there, the head of the network, and perhaps her way to Dale. Lannery led the way down a gentle slope and into the melee. In the end, Max Hagen was easy to find. Perhaps he believed that concealment would make him seem more suspicious. Or maybe he was simply too confident to hide. He was certainly one of the most unobtrusive men Lannery had ever seen.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's him,
Tree said, frowning. They were standing in a food stall, mounds of root vegetables and racks of curing meat all around. Across the wide walkway from them was a water stall. That's all it sold. Water in various container sizes. The sign above the stall exhorted, "The finest water imported from Calamar. Certificate of authenticity available to those who doubt." The man standing behind the stall talking with a family of human workers was short and fat. His dark skin wrinkled with laughter lines, and the few remaining tufts of white hair on his scalp gave him a comic appearance. His eyes were filled with good humor, and with just a few words, he had the family laughing along with him.
It is, Lannery said.
He has four people around him. The Nogri at the lizard-fighting pit along the way, three stalls away. That tattooed woman selling fate readings we passed 100 paces back. And up in the buildings around the square, one sniper with a blast rifle and another with a rocket. All watching.
You Jedi,
Tree said, but he could not hide his admiration.
Best not use that word here. So let's buy some water.
They waited behind the family, and after they left, Lannery smiled at Max Hagen and approached the stall. She kept herself sharp, reaching out with her force senses to those hidden guards she had already recognized. The last thing she would do was let Max Hagen's appearance deceive her.
Ah,
Max Hagen said when he saw Tree.
What brings you here, Tree Sauna?
Tree could not hide his surprise at being recognized. Perhaps they hadn't dealt face to face, but it seemed Max Hagen always knew who he did business with.
He's my guide, Lannery said, and we'd like to buy some of what you're selling.
Max Hagen glanced back and forth between them, and never once did his smile slip, not even from his eyes. He scratched at the corner of his mouth, and Lannery tensed,
hand drifting a little closer to the sword hidden beneath her robe. She probed at him gently, but before she'd even touched his mind, she flinched back. His thoughts were such a pit of filth that she could almost taste their rot.
Jedi,
Max Hagen whispered. And so? Lannery asked. Tree stood frozen at her side. Max Hagen stared at her, still smiling. He poured 3 cups of water from a plastoid container without even looking, lifted one to his lips, sipped.
Don't see many Jedi here.
He'd sensed her instantly. Ready this time, Lannery reached out to read him, but he was close to her now. The wall he'd thrown up was solid and vast, and it had the feel of something enhanced. He had tech implanted somewhere in his skull, under one of those tufts of hair, no doubt, and it was top-grade stuff, high-end military. His protection went far deeper than simple bodyguards. I'm doing my best not to be seen, she said.
I've nothing against Jedi, he said.
He put his cup down and handed one to each of them. Lannery took hers and nodded for Tree to do the same.
Just don't,
he waved his hands above his head.
You know, mess with my mind or any of that crap.
That might be hard, Lannery said. Max Hagen laughed out loud, and it was so infectious that she actually found herself smiling.
Well, protection is always advisable, especially in a pit like this. Tree?
He grunted and sighed.
So, time for my lunch break. Come with me and we'll talk.
He took them beneath the square, descending one of the many staircases. There was machinery down there that powered lights and air filtration, and also places where less acceptable business was conducted. Brothels, drug bars, fighting rinks. Lannery sensed and saw them all. Built in ruins that were testament to Greenwood Station's past. Sometimes it was easier to build new upon old. But Max Hagen had no interest in such underground endeavors. Through 3 doors, along several corridors, and then down a secret staircase concealed behind a locked wall panel, they emerged eventually in a room that might have impressed those corporation officials in their high tower.
Nice,
Lannery said as he led them inside. They were on their own, yet she had no doubt Max Hagen was well protected here. She felt the weight of battle droids buried in the walls, and suspected that his implanted tech probably controlled everything about this room. One wrong move, and chaos would erupt.
I do enjoy some comforts, he said. Oh, and don't think for a moment that I'm imparting any sense of trust by bringing you here. I have dozens of these rooms all over the dome. I haven't been to this particular one in a long time, as can be witnessed by...
He picked up several bottles from a table and threw them into a corner.
The bad drink selection. Apologies.
Not here to drink, Tree said.
Here to buy more mercenaries, Tree?
Max Hagen's eyes twinkled as Tree squirmed uncomfortably. But Lannery did not take the bait. I'm looking for someone, and Tree says you can help, she said. He might have arrived already, or his ship might be incoming. He'll have people with him. They call themselves Stargazers.
Looking in your Jedi capacity?
He's my brother, Lannery said. It was no answer, but it seemed to satisfy Max Hagen.
It'll cost you, but I'm a fair man in business, so I'll let you make me an offer.
500,000 credits, Tree said.
Lannery held in her surprise, and was pleased to see Max Hagen's eyes go wide.
A generous offer,
he said. Tree smiled.
I'm a fair man in business.
Max Hagen strolled around his opulent room, running his fingers along surfaces and tutting at the buildup of dust. His name's Dalian Brock, Lannery said. I need to know where he is, and he mustn't know I'm here.
Are you going to kill him?
Max Hagen asked. That's none of your business.
True. But every time I use my network, I put it at risk. And as I'm in business for pleasure, there's always a price over and above money. Generous though your offer is, Tree.
Lannery did not respond.
Added to that,
Max Hagen continued,
do you have any idea How much business would suffer if anyone knew I was helping a Jedi?
We won't tell anyone, Lannery said.
Oh, I know that.
He spoke with such assurance, such confident control, that Lannery felt a shiver down her spine. Only one other person had ever made her feel like this. Dagon Locke, the one time she'd seen him during her short retreat on Bogan. None of the others with her party had seen him, and the master supervising them had told her that it was impossible, that prisoners were kept separated by force fields. But though he had been little more than a shadow on a distant hillside, she had felt his eyes upon her, and the weight of his regard. Heavy. Dark.
So, Max Haugen continued, an answer to my question is also part of the price. Will you kill your brother?
Lannery considered the question. It was one she had confronted and struggled with already, and it had caused more distress in her than finding Dale's bloodied, torn clothing 9 years before. But the answer was already firm in her mind. Only if I absolutely have to. Max Haugen nodded. His eyes were on fire.
My stall, Dusk, he said. If he's in Greenwood Station, I'll know by then.
He plucked an electronic device from his belt and held it out to Tree.
I'd appreciate untraceable bonds, if you will. And the transfer should be the full amount.
Half now, half, Tree began.
The full amount is fine, Lannery said. I can see you're a man of honor. Max Haugen frowned for a moment, trying to make out whether Lannery was playing him. Then he laughed out loud again, head back, hand pressing his side. This time, she felt no urge to laugh with him. I need a shower, she said. I want to change my skin, buy new clothes. The man's a disease.
I did warn you.
And where do you get so much money?
You don't want to know.
I do, Lannery thought, as they walked as quickly as they could out of District 6. I do want to know. She made sure they weren't followed. Max Haugen would have his eyes on them somehow, she knew, and his attention was something they had bought along with his help. But someone following them would be too much of a threat to ignore. And she did want to know about Tree, and where his money came from, and Dusk was a while away.
I know a place we can go to, Tree began.
No, we'll walk. I don't like his knowing I'm here. He'll have a trace on us somehow, but I'll feel more comfortable on the move. Besides, I need to know this place more.
Why?
Tree asked. Useful if it comes to a fight. She nudged Tree's shoulder. Come on, let's buy a couple of tankards, drink while we're walking. We'll fit right in. And you can tell me something about yourself. They bought drinks and walked, and all the time Tree was talking, Lannery was taking in their surroundings, getting the lay of the land, locating herself in relation to the rest of the dome and the damaged sector, and possible exit routes to the outside if the need arose. She tried hard to make herself believe she wasn't being helplessly fooled by Max Haugen.
I made my name in violence and my money in secrets.
Lannery's own silence had encouraged Tree to speak, and she was not about to interrupt his flow with questions.
My third Leku set me aside, even among the Twi'lek community on Kalamar. It invited ridicule. You wouldn't think that, would you? That in a society filled with so many shapes, species, and creeds, a simple extra something would set me apart.
He snorted.
I suffered as a child, and that set me on the course I took through all my young adult years.
He fell silent, and they passed a square where small, sick-looking creatures were kept in metal-fenced stalls. The animals were completely silent, and it was the humans and other species who made the most noise, as individual subjects were hoisted up on an apparatus, hung from their back legs, and butchered. Meat and money changed hands. The cattle watched, eyes heavy with knowledge. What course? She asked.
The path of violence. I killed my first man when I was 17. A street fight outside a tavern on one of Kalamar's less salubrious islands. No one cared that he was dead, and after a day, neither did I. It had helped me. his mocking, his violence against me were washed away.
He looked down at his palms as he walked.
By his blood on my hands.
Killing should never be easy.
But it was, and I became really good at it. Defending my honor, I'd discovered that I was a fighter. Others soon noticed. I slipped into crime. There was always a part of me that resisted, but the rewards easily helped me fight back. I drove down the doubt and embraced the new worlds opening up for me. Wealth, power, status. I became feared and revered in equal measure. A name. I gathered others around me and formed my own criminal organization from the bottom up. It was unintentional, really, that creation of a gang, but it just happened, and I relished every moment. They left the square with the doomed cattle and entered a warren of narrow alleys between low buildings. The sounds of life flowed from open windows, screaming infants, arguing parents, entertainment channels, music. Lannery felt apart from all that, and the weight of her mission bore down on her even more. Her heart beat with its urgency. She should have found Dale by now. "You don't look like a crime lord," Lannery said. "You don't seem like one now." "Now I'm not. Like I said, I made my name in violence. Once that name was made, and I'd moved my operations to Chicoqua, I became one of many. I was lost. On Calamar, I'd had an empire. On Chicoqua, I was just another upstart. The real crime lords there looked down on us, picked those who they thought could help them, sometimes slaughtered those who looked beyond their station. And that was something I could not help doing. I expanded too quickly, reached too far and too fast. I was noticed.
And? Lannery asked. Trees Leku betrayed his nervousness and how uncomfortable he was with his memories.
And they gave me a chance. Killed many of my lieutenants, but saw something in me that they thought might be of use. They were...
He shook his head as if finding it difficult to explain.
Like Max Hagen, Lannery said.
Only the very least of them were like him,
Tree said.
The worst. Monsters, beyond anything I could ever want to be. They repulsed me, but they gave me a chance to live, and I took it.
What chance?
To make money by keeping secrets. I was on my own once again, and lonely. Two of the nine houses employed me to be their messenger. They gave me secrets that could not be entrusted to the written word or technology, could not be transmitted or relayed by unreliable droids. I carried such secrets for them, and if any ever escaped, I would die. I still would. I could tell you such things, Lannery.
But you won't.
No. And even the greatest Jedi could not pick them from my mind after what Dan Powell has done to me.
She's protected you, Lannery said, understanding at last. By making Trisana impenetrable even to Jedi probings, she had given him the perfect mind in which to maintain those secrets from the past that could be the death of him.
It's a small part of what she promised,
Tree said, his voice dropping.
Because I want my life back. The gangsters haven't called on me for almost a whole Tython year, but they will soon. I don't want it anymore. I want everything that Dan Powell promised. A new identity, new face, new home. And to forget everything I've done.
He laughed softly, touching his third Leku.
Surgery. I want to fade into the crowd instead of stand out. I want to be normal.
You'll never be normal, she thought. Not after what you've seen and done. And Lannery should know. But she said nothing to shatter his dreams. While he still dreamed, he could help her. She felt sorry for him, but she also recognized that a wish to leave such a life did not absolve him of the guilt he had earned. He'd told her only a small part of what he had done. His red skin was stained with blood, though of how many victims she would never know.
After this, Dan Powell will set me free, he said.
He seemed so confident. So sure. She's a master of her word, Lannery said. And she gave me a large part of what I am, too. Tree raised an eyebrow, and his Leku formed the questioning touch. But Lannery said no more.
He might have opened his heart, but her story was not one to share with someone like Trisana. Lannery nodded to the dome's western expanse, where filtered yellow light bled weakly across the city. Dusk is close. Time to hear Max Hagen.
Chapter 12. Chasm.
Ashlaw. Bogan. They're just moons. My own destiny lies elsewhere, and it has such gravity.
Dalian Brock, Diaries, 10,661 TYA, Thoyor Arrival. Lannery wakes from a dream of home, in which she is dreaming of the stars, and Dale is sitting beside her. He is bathed in firelight, but most of his face is in shadow. Still, she can read him from his stance and his stillness. He is staring at her with a terrifying coldness. What? Is there something? But she knows there is no threat from outside. They are a day away from Anil Kesh, camped beneath a copse of heartberry trees. They have eaten several berries each, and Lannery's stomach is warm and comfortably full, the berry's goodness thrumming through her. There is wildlife in these foothills that might mean them harm. Acid spiders, and rumors of a family of flame tigers that cross the Moon Islands. But she would sense if any of them came close. She would know.
I am the chasm,
Dale says. His voice is lower than before, deeper, as if echoing from somewhere deep. What do you mean? She sounds like a scared little girl. She is scared. Dale shifts, turning toward the fire so that its light reveals his face. He is still her brother, but he looks older than before. Wiser. As if she is seeing a Dale who has already completed his great journey.
I have depths waiting to be filled.
Places you can never see and go, because you're Jedi.
And my depths are my own, not steered by something else.
The Force doesn't steer me, Dale.
He snorts. She is even more scared. She went to sleep still knowing who her brother was, but now...
What happened?
She asks.
I am the chasm. I have depths to explore and fill.
Depth implies mystery and fullness. But in you I sense only void.
Your Force tells you that,
he says, almost spitting the words.
And you believe it?
No. I know that because of my love for you as a brother.
For the briefest instant, a look of regret seems to cross his face. But perhaps it is merely a flame from the fire, casting a sympathetic shadow.
My own great journey ends soon, he says. After I've taken everything I can from Tython, bled it of everything that can be of use, I'll be leaving. Don't get in my way.
At dusk the next day, they approach Anil Kesh. Lannery has heard many stories about this place, but nothing can prepare her for the reality. The temple itself is an incredible structure, graceful and brooding, huge and yet insectile in its shape and proportions. An engineering marvel that surpasses any other on Tython. Its Thoyor floats about it, sometimes close, sometimes farther away. It's believed that it drifts with the Force. Beneath the temple, the chasm. One of the most amazing places on Tython, and also one of the most enigmatic and dangerous. The chasm is a seemingly bottomless pit within which Force storms rage and mystery resides. No Jedi has ever gone deep enough to find the chasm's bottom, or if they have, they have never returned. The stronger one is with the Force, the greater the chasm's detrimental influence, disorientation, pain, and eventually death. Many have tried. Some have died, and some have gone so deep that they returned insane, deluded. Suicide is common among those who ignore all warnings and their own better judgment to try.
Lannery
One of Anil Kesh's main aims is to plumb the depths of the chasm, because it is Tython and the Force at its most mysterious. Lannery has seen hollows of Temple Master Quan Zhang discussing the chasm, and even through these, she can sense his awe and fascination. The Jedai, he says, will find the bottom one day. It's what might exist there that possesses them to keep trying.
I am the chasm, Dale said.
Standing close to Anil Kesh now, Lannery expects him to be staring at this strange wound in the land, but he seems untouched and unconcerned. Unlike him, she can feel the draw of the chasm and its incredible primeval power. The Force is in turmoil within her. She feels sick. To manage that sickness, she knows, will be one of her first lessons at Anil Kesh. This is not the final destination of their great journey, but Lannery cannot help feeling the sense of an ending hanging over them both. Greenwood Station was a city that never slept. The sun had set, and the dome was now illuminated by hundreds of huge lights suspended beneath the massive support ribs. They were a poor substitute for the sun, but Lannery supposed this was their night. Shifts were changing. The air was filled with the smells of industry and cooking and sewage, and she and Tree were once again approaching Max Hoggins' imported water stall. She saw him from a distance, closing broken shutters across his tables and instructing several helpers on where to store those bottles not yet sold. He waved away a couple of late customers with an apologetic smile, then saw Lannery. His smile remained, but it was no longer soft. Lannery did not break her stride, but she did feel comfort from the Force flowing through her. Muscles tensed, her sword sang with power, and her senses, always alert, became attuned to danger. Max Hoggin was her focus, but if he meant her harm, then he would desire that focus. Any attack would come from those around him.
Trisana, Max Hoggin called. Lannery, so good to see you both again.
Tree glanced around nervously to see if anyone else had heard his name, and Lannery could not help smiling. She wondered how many enemies the Twi'lek had made over the years. I'm surprised you'd close up shop, Lannery said.